My name is Helena Kennedy. I'm a lawyer of many years' practice here in the United Kingdom, but now an international lawyer, and I'm a member of the House of Lords. And the thrill that I have today is in welcoming the wonderful Sandy Okoro. Her trajectory in the law is really one that should be inspirational to us all. Sandy, I want you to just tell people a little bit about yourself and how you came into the law. You didn't come from a background in which the law had figured, or where you had people, forebears who had been in the law.
My father came from Nigeria, my mum came from Trinidad. They met here, and I was born in Fulham, but grew up in Balham in South London. It was a different era when I was born, and there were different expectations for young girls and for young girls from ethnic minorities as well.
Well, you were a tiny black girl in Balham, but you made it clear that you had ambitions, and I'd like you to tell everyone about them.
Yeah, so I think I was about 7 years old. I was in my primary school class and the teacher was asking everybody what they wanted to be. And I couldn't wait, Helena, to say what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to be a judge. And the teacher turned around to me and said, little black girls don't become from Balham don't become judges. And I was a little bit appalled, but at the same time, a little bit stubborn, thinking, well, if they don't, they're going to now. And sometimes people say, what would you say to that teacher if you ever saw them again? And I would say, thank you. Thank you for giving me something to work towards that you thought wouldn't happen. Now, I'm not a judge, but, you know, I am Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the World Bank Group. And if I'd said, OK, I'll do that instead, I don't think she would have said, oh, that's a more, you know, realistic. My ambition came from watching Crown Court. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And so I held on to that ambition. And I went to Putney and things became very different there. They really encouraged, it was an all-girls school, still is an all-girls school. And they really encouraged, if that's what you want to do, you do it, right? I also went on lots of marches, anti-apartheid marches. I went, wanted to promote human rights and everything. But that was a time when there wasn't a lot of that around in the world in the same way that it is now. And so I became very, I wouldn't say militant, but I became very much aware of my surroundings. And apartheid in South Africa existed. And I saw the way lawyers played an important role. And of course, Nelson Mandela was a lawyer. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be one of those lawyers that changes the world and makes a difference. The Big Bang happened in the city and there was suddenly more space for lawyers in the city, and I thought, why don't I give that a go? That's another glass ceiling that people say someone like you cannot work in the city. And I was told then as well, when I started to look, people were saying, oh no, you need to change your surname, it's too ethnic sounding, that won't work in the city. And I refused to do that, and that wasn't true either. I got opportunities and roles there.
Certainly it was hard for women to go into commercial law and to go into that the business of corporate law, the area of high finance. So what happened? How was that when you moved in that direction? Where did you go?
So my first move in that direction was to Schroders. And I was only 25 when I started Schroders, and I landed managing a department. So this black young girl jumps into a very traditional white male environment and you're managing it. It was a small trust department there. Being an in-house lawyer was not very popular at that time. It's where people who couldn't make it went to go. Anyway, so there was an opportunity and I took it and I loved it. The city really, really worked for me. I love the having to think on your feet. I love the challenges. I could deal with sexism. To be honest, there wasn't as much of it as you would think. And there certainly wasn't as much racism as you would think. I never looked at it as this is a really tough place to be, because back then everywhere was a really tough place to be. I realize now when I look back just how professional it actually was and how unusual I was. It was a little bit intimidating, particularly when, you know, you're in a very traditional environment and you have men who are older than you who have to report to you. But at the end of the day, it worked out very well because you were all learning as you went along. And that's one thing I would say, is that if you are willing to learn and you are willing to pick up all these new skills, you can do it.
I want to ask you about the whole business of diversity and inclusion. It's one of the discussions that are being had almost in every walk of life and in every public space, that it is better to embrace difference, because actually it is not only is it about justice and about fairness that people are given opportunities wherever they might want to pursue them, but also that actually it has a better impact. Do you think it did make a difference to outcomes? More women having more people from ethnic minorities?
I think we don't have enough at this moment in time. So let me just say, we don't have enough. There's still a way to go. But what we have done so far has made such a difference, right? It's made a difference, not just in you know, the outcomes for your customers and your clients and your society, but it's made a difference, I think, to the world as a whole, your workplace, your communities, everything else like that. You know, we all kind of do internet banking, we all do those sorts of things. It has, when we're looking at that, the customer, you've got to think who your customer is. And it is a whole group of people all over the world. So you have to be diverse. You have to reflect that in your staff as well. Otherwise, you will miss opportunities. You won't understand what it is your customers want. You won't understand the change in the world. And you also need a lot of young people as well, too. So it's diversity of age as well. And I think this is just so important. Better outcomes, better financial outcomes, better workplace. We would not have as much advancement as we've had in making the workplace safer for women, sexual harassment, et cetera, if you didn't have women in powerful positions in the workplace.
Yeah.
We're not there yet. There's still a lot to do. But the way the workplace has changed to be, you know, a much less 9-to-5, less sitting at your desk, a bit more people-centered, a bit more people-centered approach is because you have more diversity and you're thinking about your people.
There's always this old argument about, do women do anything any differently, you know? Do they go in there and just do it in exactly the same way as the guys, especially if they've been trained in the law to sort of practice law in a particular way? Does it make a difference?
I think we do. And I think different women bring different things as well. In a way, different men bring different things. But as women, we bring that experience to the table of the fact that this isn't easy to get there, right? But still, it isn't easy to get there. And that is a really important experience, because you almost have to be, you have to make sure you do everything right. You can't take any shortcuts as a woman. And then if you're a Black woman, the expectation is a failure, right? It's not of a success. You don't walk into the room and they go, oh, we're really lucky now, we're going to make it. They go, oh, okay, let's see. So that means actually you're really smart and you're really clued up as to what's going on.
How do you change institutions which are, you know, have existed for, you know, eons, you know, particularly here in the United Kingdom, but it's true in all parts of the world, institutions that have existed for such a long time that actually they have practices and ways of being that are very set in stone.
Well, I think the first thing is there has to be a willingness to change. And there has to be a willingness to want to survive the next 10 years, to be honest, because I think there's a lot of change coming. One of the things I see with many traditional institutions is the inability sometimes to look forward. What is the world going to be like in 2050? Take the United Kingdom. What is that going to look like? It's not going to look like the same as it looked at like in 1950. You can keep the tradition, as an Alexander McQueen said, the tradition, but break the rules. Move forward, look to the future. Who are your clients going to be? Who are you going to have to attract as talent to your institutions to work in? Because they're going to have a lot of choice. Hmm. And a lot of people are now choosing the entrepreneurial route. They're choosing to set up their own businesses. How are you going to attract people to come into something for the future? You're going to have to modernize it.
And inside an organization, whether it's a company or whether it's a large organization of another kind, like the World Bank, you're really there, making sure there is good governance, that there is that standards are maintained.
You are, and you are doing that for the institution. So often people say, well, who's your client as a GC? The answer is the institution is your client. And you have many stakeholders, which could be the regulators, which could be the shareholders and the customers. So you have to make sure everything is fair for everybody. But you are really there to make sure, you know, that everything is done with integrity. Rules and regulations are followed. good governance, doing the right thing. You are there to help guide your institution do that. You are advisory though, right? You can't say you have to. That doesn't work either. But you're advising them in a way, and you have to do that, showing them what the risks are. Regulation, governance, etc., has become really important. Good governance will save you. Bad governance will kill you. And you need your GC and your legal team to guide you through that. And that will instill really good behaviours in staff as well, which is really important. Because I think the way that people behave now is becoming a real issue in institutions. That can take you down.
Does the World Bank ever wag a finger at a country about its value system or about how it's behaving itself when it comes to the business of borrowing money? I mean, does it say, listen, while you carry on treating a whole section of your community in an unacceptable way, we can't lend you money. You've got to get that sorted out.
No, we don't. And we're not allowed to do that under our articles. Our articles have a political prohibition that mean we can only lend based on economic considerations. That's very clear. So we cannot, and we lend to our member countries. So the first thing is, are you a member? Then if you're a member, that's one tick. And then you look at the normal things you'd look at as to whether or not you need to lend, want to lend. We lend to the member country. The governments change. Governments change in all member countries. However, one of the things we do in our lending programs, and it's part of the agreements, is we have environmental and social safeguards built in so that we ensure that there is equal treatment when it comes to access to the things that we are building, say a hospital. It gets complicated sometimes, but we have 187 member countries. If we were to play politics with all that different politics around the table, nobody would be lent any money.
When you're giving money, does the fact that a country might be opening its borders to refugees therefore become a consideration for you, as distinct from the countries that are closing their borders to the arrival of people fleeing horrible events like conflicts?
Well, first of all, we don't tell countries they have to borrow money from us. They have to come to us wanting to borrow money. And so a number of our member countries who have been taking refugees have come to the bank for lending to help with that. So we have been lending money to a number of countries who have taken refugees.
And I just wondered to what extent climate change is something that might be discussed at the bank. Because, of course, there are lots of countries that are going to be particularly at risk. They're almost invariably the poorest. But there are issues for all of us. Does that come into your considerations in the lending process?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. It's really at the heart of a lot of things that we are doing. We have worked out by the end of this decade, so the end of the 20s, that 132 million people will be living in extreme poverty because of climate change. And our role is to end extreme poverty. So we're right in the heart of it. It's one of the most central themes that we have at the bank. And every project we do, every bit of lending, we really look at it from that angle as well. And the other thing is that COVID has really changed things as well when it comes to our mission. So you've not just got climate, but you've got the overlay of COVID on top of that as well. And I'll give you another statistic that we think that because in a post-COVID world, 100 million more people will be living on less than $1.90 a day. That's our definition of poverty, living on less than $1.90 a day. We have been the largest multilateral funder of climate investments in developing countries. And we've accounted for $26 billion in 2021 alone, which is historic. So we're really putting our money where our mouth is on climate. This is an existential crisis for the planet.